Thank you for listening to this podcast brought to you by the Center for Christian Music Studies at Baylor University. This podcast was recorded at the 2012 Alleluia Conference. For more information about Alleluia, visit our website where you will find conference dates and details, audio and video recordings, and a list of confirmed clinicians for next summer's event. For this information and more, visit us online at www.baylor.edu/alleluia.
This session is a bit of a response to a book that's coming out soon called From Memory to Imagination. And here is a pre-publication copy of this book, which is to be out the end of August. And I'll pass this around so you can kind of thumb through it and see. What we're doing today is really just kind of taking an image from this book and exploring it a bit and just kind of riffing on that just a tad, but that's really what we're doing today. I've done several sessions along through the years. I think I might have done something last year on the whole concept of imagination. And I was asking students, what might I talk about, or what something you might have heard in class that I should mention, or would be a good thing to talk about at Alleluia? And several of them said, well, you've talked a lot about imagination. What if you talk a little bit about memory and kind of deal with the whole memory issue? And so it's been both the book and then some thought for this particular time has been really helpful to kind of probe into how memory both affects us now. I think oftentimes when we think about memory, we think about the past. And we think memory is just something there, and it deals with old, and it's aged, and it's something that older people do, and all those kind of things. But to think how memory affects what we do now, and think of how memory then becomes a launching pad for what we do in the future, I think is really significant. And that's kind of what we're going to do today. So how does memory affect worship in our own congregations? How does it affect the way we lead? How does it affect who we become and how we engage others and how we hear what others offer? And then really, we'll talk a little bit about how memory affects kind of church systems and how churches respond and how they work. So that's kind of what we're about today. First of all, let's just talk for a moment about what is memory. When you think about memory, what are some things that you might say memory is? I wrote down a few little things here, but what are some things, what is memory? What do you imagine memory to be? Or even what is memory not might be something, but what is memory?
A word that comes to my mind is connections.
Okay.
Because I think of, you know, like, for example, in church music, you know, when you think of connections, my wife, the hymn, How Great Thou Art, has a connection for her of her grandmother's funeral. So a couple of years ago, we did a multilingual service where How Great Thou Art was sung in Spanish. She was in tears, even though it wasn't in English. It was because of that memory, that connection, that image with the song.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. Memory connects us to people, to places, to things, to experiences. Yeah, it helps us literally to relive, to be there again, as I think about memory often. It transports me negatively or positively into other places. Yeah. What else do you think about?
It shapes us.
It does. Yeah. It shapes us in many ways, in ways that we don't even recognize, I think. And we're going to explore that a little bit more, but absolutely.
It's multi-sensory.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. How's a way that memory is multi-sensory? That's a great, great observation.
Food or a visual.
Do you ever walk through a mall and somebody walks past you and you think you're close to somebody that's not the person because of the cologne this person is wearing or a smell or something? We know that smell is the most emotional of all the senses. And most of the time when we think, I think I've been here before, kind of a deja vu experience. Often it's a smell that is engaging us. Yeah. It's amazing how you walk in a place and smell a certain food or even the smell of home. You know, I notice the smell of home when I'm gone for a few days. You know, and I walk back in and I think, this is good. I like this. Yeah. Very good. What else?
I think
memory is connected to pleasure. I think the reason musical form relies on memory so strongly is because it's a part of the pleasure of the musical experience to hear something again that we've heard before. It's why, you know, radio stations play the same song every 30 minutes because we want to hear something we've heard before. And so I think that memory is strongly connected with pleasure. And perhaps as we get older, I think memories become even more pleasurable.
It's definitely connected to pleasure, and it's connected to repetition, isn't it? We right. want to repeat the things that make us, that are good. It's also connected to pain.
Of course.
Yeah, it's equally connected to pain. Yeah, Caleb.
I think memory is also connected to experiences that we don't want to relive and things we do to avoid doing something that we may have harmed somebody with.
Or been harmed, or harmed ourselves, or, yeah. Memory helps us learn in that way, doesn't it? It helps us say, I don't want to be there again. Or, I want to be there many times. Yeah. Memory informs things, for instance, what we do this week. In our worship this week, we've tried to have memory experiences and things that connect to the past and things that connect to different people's past and things that move us into new places that create new memories. And then once those happen again, then we're not approaching them for the first time. Then it's a memory experience and we're building onto something. And we're using them contextually to launch us forward. But for instance, singing It Is Well With My Soul the first day. For many of us, that would be about as heartful as music would get if we just go to a, you know, really basic kind of level. But we need to hear that. We need that experience because then that can launch us into not just repeating It Is Well With My Soul, but then launching us into new things. And it sets us up for experiencing new. Some other ideas about just general things about what is memory. This is very good, very helpful. Yes?
I think of memory as a storehouse where I can pick and choose and use it for the past, the present, or the future.
It's an excellent idea. And we do pick and choose our memories. We're very selective about them, and we alter them. And we make them work for us, which can be positive and not so positive. Yeah, yeah, very good. Well, memory is more than recall. It's more than facts. It's more than just saying something and being accurate. Some of us prize accurate memories, and some of us, the worst thing that someone could do is impose fact and content into our story. It would just completely ruin it for us, wouldn't it? Okay? Yeah. It's interesting to watch, when we think about memory as a shared experience, it's very interesting to watch spouses share memories. I was in a group with a couple a few years ago in a small group, and I had the most delightful experience watching them tell stories. Because any life story that would come up, one of them would start the story and they'd say, oh, no. It wasn't like, and they would jump in, and then the other one would jump in, and it was just this total tag team, you know. And it was really quite beautiful because they were very respectful of each other, but it took both of them to get any story, and they were both pretty factually oriented people. So it was just an interesting dance to watch them and how they would flow back and forth with that memory. Yeah. What we also find is that when we have losses in our lives, that we lose memory, in a sense. If you've lost a parent or lost a sibling. Recently, my parents are aging significantly, and probably for the last four trips home, I said, you know, I've got to take a video camera, and I want to get some of my dad's stories. My dad's quite a storyteller, and I want to get some of his stories videoed. I'd love to have those for the future. Because what I know is I could tell the story, but I can't tell it like my dad. I can't tell it with his accent. I can't tell it with his interesting laugh. And I could never capture that again. And so what I fear is that if he were gone, his stories are gone. But who else's stories are gone? Mine are, yeah. I lost a brother when I was 29 years old, Well, I wasn't 29. Actually, I had a birthday 6 days after my brother died. But in that process, I realized that what I had lost was memory. And when our family got together after that, we weren't nearly as good at telling our family stories because his lines were gone and his part and his corrections and, you know, his perspective was not there anymore. We didn't dance as well anymore because families play, you know, you're the straight guy, I'm the funny guy, and then we switch roles and all this stuff. And we realized that the stories don't come out the same, and you have to reimagine your family's story when you lose. And some of you have lost spouses and, you know, gone through painful experiences of loss, and you know that it changes everything when you have to learn to tell your story and act it out a bit differently. Yeah. But it's certainly more than just than facts and recall. It's more than intellectual or emotional response. It is about that, but it's more than that. I say that it's something you never want to be without. I think if you were to poll us, we would probably say, the last thing I want to lose is my memory. How many people do you say, if I could just keep my mind as I age? You know, oh, I don't want to lose my mind. Okay? So it is the thing that we never want to be without. And even as we find ourselves moving into more middle-aged things, and our recall perhaps of names is not as good as it was, and we find ourselves looking at tags a lot more than we might have at some other times, we start to realize that things are changing, and that's what I don't want to lose. It's very sensitive to us. It's foundational, as you've said so beautifully. It really gives our life meaning, and it helps us to be transported into places. Mostly we think of the places we like to go. What is memory's role in our life? It grounds us, it contextualizes our lives and ministry. It helps us to have a firm context. Creates a basis for emotion. Would you think with me for a moment about what is the happiest moment of your life? If you were to say, this is when happiness was at, every happiness moment in my life is measured up and against this one. What might be an experience that you might put up there as, you know, wow, this was it?
Birth of a child.
Yeah. Yeah, the birth of a child, or in our case, the receiving a child. Yeah.
Marriage.
Marriage. Mm-hmm.
When I accepted Christ as my Savior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Your favorite Christmas gift.
Yeah, yeah. And when everything was just right, you know, yeah. Yeah. We'd be different for a lot of us. We could also turn those same experiences around, and they could be the most painful experience. The birth of a child that, for whatever reason, was not good timing. Might be amazingly difficult. I've stood by a bride before who said, I don't know if I want to do this, but it's too late. And she launched. That's a painful experience. Yeah.
So sometimes it's the same experience. Mm-hmm. We had occasion in our last church, we celebrated, they dedicated a building on December 7, 1941. And in telling that story as a part of our centennial, we had one man who survived Pearl Harbor on deck watching the planes go over, and another man who, out of that same experience, lost a brother on one of the ships that went down. Mm. So telling the same story for one was a time of salvation, another it was a time of pain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm glad you said that, Larry. I think that's an absolutely beautiful thing. And I have begun to believe that the moments that we know we're most alive are the moments when our grief and our joy are juxtaposed. We will never feel more emotion at any time in our life than when we have the juxtaposition of pain and grief totally coming together. And I've begun to see those as, I'm really not dead. Yeah. I'm really not dead. I think that's one of the reasons that I have relished the experiences of traveling, particularly to Africa, so much, is because there's some of the most amazing joy in that culture that I've ever experienced, and some of the deepest pain all wrapped in the same wrapper. it's right there, and I'm feeling, and I'm just, and I'm feeling a sense of emotional stuff from different places that says, you know, there's a lot still in you, you know, and I think those are tough places, yeah, but important ones. Very, very wise. So it determines how we. It creates a basis for emotion. So when we have this is a high, this is a low, then we know what's in the middle. And we know how to, we have these places. If we were working in a counseling situation, oftentimes what happens when we are not in healthy places is we don't know what's high and what's low, and we can't figure out, we don't know what the middle is, and we are all out of whack, in a sense, okay? And so our emotional barometer is skewed. It establishes basic responses such as safety, trust, and love. We know when we're safe. How? How do you know when you feel safe? You've been there before. That's right. You go back to a place. This was a safe place. Therefore, I am safe or not. I think it's one reason that some of us, big people, still love to go home. You know, it's a reason that I love to go home, because there's something safe about that. I think it's also a reason that we grieve the loss of parents so deeply, is because when that parent is gone, we're the next one in line. And literally, it's my turn. I'm next. I'm up next. So, yeah. So safety is based on that. How do you perceive love? How do you know when you're loved? You've been loved before, and then you know you're loved. You base that on the love you've experienced in the past. And then if you are able to experience deeper love, then that changes how that moves. Yeah. I talked with a woman who was my fifth grade teacher, who is... still alive, and she and her husband are now in the nursing home in our hometown. But he was my elementary school principal, and she was my fifth grade teacher. At that time, they were not married. He was a single man in his mid-40s or so, or early 50s, who'd never been married, and her husband had died. When I was in high school, they married, and that was quite scandalous, as you can imagine, in a very, very small town. But I remember going by the elementary school, because I believed I was sort of her favorite, and I think we would both kind of share that. And so I went by to visit her often and get my hugs and affirmation and all those things. But she was telling me about her marriage, and she said, "My marrying Mr. Johnson is the biggest compliment I could give my former husband. I could give my deceased husband." She said, "Because I loved him so much and I had such a great, wonderful life with him, I wanted to have that again." And so that's always changed the way I have viewed that you have loved, therefore you can love. You can go back to that, you can love, and you want that again if that has been a part of your life. So you see how that contextualizes our experiences and changes things for us. It deepens current experiences by situating them within and against previous experiences. When we know what has been, then we know how to situate them. We know where to put something, and we know when it's good, it is good. One of the things that I say to students, Adam is going to be a student here, and Bodhi has been, and others of you, I say this often, is know where you are, and know that the times are good. If you don't know that these days are, if you don't stop and reflect, you won't know that these days are good. And they will pass you by, and then you will say, "Oh my goodness, those days at Baylor were amazing, and I didn't even know it." But if you experience it and you know it, then that's double. Then you get a double deal. I've tried with our children to every day stop and say, you know, "I am grateful. This is good. This is beautiful. This is a wonderful day for me." I've tried to stop, and, you know, even if it's just going in and looking at them when they're asleep. You know, I have a habit of I go in and kiss both of our children every night when they're asleep, and then they can't resist me. You know, and I just, you know, Isaac said, I said, well, Isaac, I'll come back in and check on you later. And he said, well, Dad, you really don't have to do that at this age. And I said, well, you know, but it's what I want to do, Isaac. And I said, and really knowing I'm going to come back in might help you feel safe too. Yeah. But it's knowing it's good. And then you can know it now and you can know it in the future. Yeah. And life becomes richer through that kind of experience. It allows us to develop continually in both a corporate setting, but it allows continual development and continual adding on. It lets us share our stories with others and receive other stories. We are not able to share our stories unless we can remember. And if we don't practice memory, we will not have it. So why do families tell stories, and why should we tell Christ stories? So that we can remember them. We keep telling them so that we remember them. And why is it that when we go home, we say, Papa, tell us about whatever. We keep telling the stories because we want to remember them and we want to re-experience them. So they, and the other side of that is when we have memory, we are able to receive them. The people that do not hear stories are the people that really don't have a narrative. There's not stability and there's not really memory established. That's really important to think about how we relate to people, I think, and why sometimes some people can't hear your story because there's not a connection. There's not a place where they are able. There's not a place to put that story. I was talking to somebody recently about something pretty painful, and I said, my perception is this person has no place to put this story. In his world, this is not a possible story. This story cannot exist from his experiences. So that's important to think about. It weaves a meta-narrative that connects us to all people and places. It puts us in the context of a really, really big picture. It puts us in a worldwide connection. It puts us into a God story. It helps us to connect our lives into what is really, really major and big. When we can't see ourselves in a bigger picture, then that's an issue. One of the things that this week does for me is that all year, I will be connecting to you in my memory. And when I'm doing things that, like sending emails and just details and contracts and negotiations and all kinds of things, then I will stop at different times and I will say, oh, but there are people behind this. And there are people for whom this matters, and there are people that are behind this story. There are memories here that make this matter. Okay, and that contextualizing and connection to a larger picture, a meta-narrative of sorts, is very valuable. I think when we lose that, then that's where we start to burn out in our ministries many times, as we lose the idea that we are connected beyond just ourselves, and what we're about is much bigger than what we're doing in our own world. Connects us to God's continual story of redemption. Leonard Sweet, in his session earlier this morning, was really connecting us to the larger picture of God's redemptive story, which was, I was just amen and all over the place because it was connecting with me. I needed the perspective that, it doesn't end here. It didn't start here, and it does not end here. It's way bigger. How does memory shape us? Bad memories haunt and they hold us back. We've talked about that. Positive memories launch us forward and they give us energy and vision. Absolutely. Much of the therapy that we're involved in our lives revolves around memory. If you've been to counseling and been to a therapist before, and many of us have, much of what you do is talk about what has happened and how did that affect you and how were you shaped by that. And then we work to identify these things, to come in contact with them, to reshape them maybe, or to reimagine them in different ways. So really, that's a lot of what memory is, just powerful. We're getting the picture here. Much of church conflict is shaped by conflicting memories. Now, some of these are some thoughts I haven't really had before. But I've begun to believe that much of conflict in our church lives is related around conflicting memories. That Mark has a memory, and for him, his memory is complete reality and it is right and it's real. My memory from my experience does not match up. So what I would value would not be the same, and our memories collide, and then we're acting out of our memories, which is normal and okay. And then there's conflict. So we're going to talk about that a little bit more as we talk about worship in a bit. But I want you to hold that one and think about it a bit. A memory must be nurtured and guarded. We've talked about that, we've touched on that well. Memory is closely tied to our ability to act and to improvise. Recently, this idea comes a bit from Dr. Travis. And so I give him credit here. But he was recently speaking about improvisation. And his idea was that he can improvise because he has practiced, and that he can improvise because he has practiced ideas, and they're in his fingers and they're in his mind, and he has the structures that can shape improvisation, structures around which he can build improvisation. And then he turned that story a bit and said, life is improvisation. And what we practice and what is inside us will be what comes out. And then he went further to say that most of the interactions we have in our lives, almost everything we do every day, is improvisatory. So, how many experiences do you have, how many conversations do you have in a day that you know what's going to be said, that you know the script? Not very many. I think family conversations tend to often be scripted more than anybody else's, especially with children. You know, same question, same answer. You know, those things that push boundaries are. But typically in a day, you know, you go into a meeting with someone, you know what the subject is, but you don't know what's going to come out. You do not know where that is. So you're continually dancing. You're making up the dance. It's all improvisation. Okay. Whether good things come out of your mouth or from your body, language, or whatever, depends on what you've been practicing. And it depends on how you have responded in the past. And it's deeply shaped by your memory. It's deeply shaped. So that whole idea of improvisatory thinking has really been important for me to think about that. And it's been important for me to work through situations that are not good and where life has not treated me well or I haven't treated life well. And it's helped me to try to reshape those so that what is inside me and what is there will be hopefully a good thing and hopefully will come out in an improvisatory way. Very important, I think, this whole improvisatory experience and how memory informs that and shapes it. How is memory cultivated? I think the important question is here why doing matters so much. Doing is really what we do, we remember. That's pretty well documented. Memory is cultivated through experiences. So all experiences create a memory in some way or another. They do shape us. All that we do shapes our memory. We have memories we'd like to erase and ones we'd like to enhance. We often do that. And our minds are good to us in that our mind will often help to minimize what wasn't good and expand what was. So my goal is to hold enough pain that I know where not to go, but have enough joy that I'm living in that joy. And that's a tough place to be. But if we completely suppress the pain, then what happens to us?
Same mistakes.
We keep on going back there. We keep going back to those same places. Yeah. So pain is our friend. Yeah. As much as we want to send him away or her away. To create memories, we must take risk necessary to put ourselves in new places and take new adventures. Oftentimes, particularly as we age, that's just not true at all. Oftentimes, we're not willing to have new adventures. Some college students are not willing to have new adventures. They have, unfortunately, almost, I guess, lived enough life already, and they expect this little tiny slice to just sustain them. Well, it's not. Yeah. But when we take new adventures, when we take risks, we will have new memories. You will have, Leonard Sweet said, there are no relationships without risks. We know that. All new experiences have risks. What is risky about a new experience?
Unknown.
It's new. Yeah, it's unknown. You don't know. You simply don't know. Therefore, it is always a risk. But if we're not cultivating new memories, then we go to what's next. That memory can be a liability when it's depended on too heavily. We can get stuck in memory at any age. Where would you imagine, worship-wise, that young people might be stuck? Younger people, college kids and high school kids, where are they stuck in memory?
With the youth group.
Okay. All right. Our son just went to youth camp. So when he came back, what was his most important memory?
That experience.
That experience. That was the pinnacle of a Christian experience, you know, of a worship experience. Okay. And that was last week, you know. Now, we all know that what happens to those memories?
They fade.
Yeah. And perhaps what we are left with is some song, some experience, some feeling, some nugget of something long down the line. What about memory with older people? How could you cast that into some? Where might memory be for them?
Older.
Yeah. It might be from youth camp for them. You know, our college worship. You talk to old people sometime, and oh, back in whenever, you know, whatever. Yeah. It's hard not to be that person, you know, as we get older. We just tell the stories and, you know, bore the world, you know. But, you know, here we go. Yeah.
And it's one of the things that makes worship difficult because you've got eight
That's
generations
right. mm-hmm.
in a building at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we can't all have our story, right? And so memory, but when we get stuck in it, that's when there's a problem. So how would we be stuck in it? How would you say that is different than just it enlivening and pushing us forward? What would be true about being stuck in it?
Well, you would expect all of your current experiences to replicate what you went through that was so positive.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a new couple in our church that are in their 60s, and probably in their 40s, they went through a life-changing experience with church. So they are sort of wanting us to do things the way they did things 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It worked then. Mm-hmm. It was good then. It was good for that time. Therefore, it is good for all time. And we build a monument around a time, a place, an experience, a moment, a song, a person. And it's all of those. It's all of those. Do you have people in your church that said, you know, when, you know, Brother John was our pastor, you know, or when, you know, so it could be people, place, thing, song, whatever, when we used to sing, when we, whatever. Mm-hmm. The implication is we don't do that anymore, mm-hmm. you know.
But the shared experience is one of the strongest things
mm-hmm.
that you can have.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that experience is positive or negative, that's kind of where we've come from in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Years.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a separating thing.
Yeah.
You ask anybody who was on site or worked with 9/11 closely, and if you were not there, you don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a separating thing. But for those who went through it,
mm-hmm.
there's no stronger bond than knowing whether I knew you before or not, we went through this experience together, and because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to create trustworthy places for new experiences that allow us to bond regardless of the generation, regardless, but how do we do that? That's the question.
There you go.
But why speak to the rock, run that risk, when you know that striking the rock brings results?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great, great ideas. It's interesting to say, how long ago was 9/11?
12 years.
Okay, so how old will this year's college freshmen have been with that experience?
Seven.
Okay. All right. So if you were born in 1942, then World War II is just as relevant for you as 9/11 is for this 18-year-old. Now, that's perspective giving to me. I was born in 1960. And, you know, when people talk about World War II when I was growing up, that might as well have been, I mean, where I'm from, they talked about the Civil War as much as they did World War II. But, you know, it might as well have been, I mean, it was so long ago for me that it was really not relative to my experience. Okay. So you see how quickly what we view as what older people, me, would view as relevant is not very relevant at all, and how that shifts so quickly. So we have to continually refurbish those memories and tell those new stories and reimagine them. This little quote here, you can look at that later, and there's a misspelled word, and I deeply apologize. It went through several proofings by smarter people than I, and anyway, it survived. But memories that were pulsating with relevancy and wonder become stagnant and murky, and they lack clarity, and they have unhealthy meaning and power. And then it just goes on to say, once living trees, we eventually turn to stone, and our memories are petrified. But to keep going from there, all memory is subjective. It's based with interpretation and forgetfulness. Yeah, it is never fully accurate. It's easy to see the inaccuracies of other people's memories, especially if we are a fact kind of person, but we typically don't see the inaccuracies of our own, because we shape them so that they serve us. Have you told a story before? Many, many times. I have a few stories that I'm kind of known for. And have you ever gone back to think how that story has sort of morphed over time, and how it's been gently reshaped? Perhaps it's not that it's not true anymore. It's just a bit better, you know. You know, you took a little here and put a little here and added and reshaped. You know, that preachers do that really effectively, I think, you know. Because you're always saying, did that really happen that way? You know. But that's part of storytelling, and it's part of what we do. But we don't think of memory as truth. But if we can think of our own memories as not truth, real truth, whatever real truth might be, but if we can think of that, then it helps us to listen to other people's memories and not shoot holes in them and hear their stories. Memory needs a community to interpret. Well, above that, it's always selective and more selective, which we said, but it needs a community to interpret. So to really get to the truth, if you're in a new church, like Mark's in a fairly new congregation, you hear a lot of stories when you're in a new place, which is part of what you're needing to do. But you don't hear one story. If you hear one story, that will not be the story. The story is a communal story. And it takes everybody to tell that story. And our family, I love it when we have a lot of family members together, because we can piece together a story. And it's interesting how I was at home not long ago, and some of my cousins were there, and we were telling some stories and talking about some things. And if you put four of us together, we could get a pretty good story because of what I remembered and she remembered and he remembered. But one of us, you know, I couldn't have remembered that had their memory not been a catalyst for my memory. I've totally forgot about that. But once they mentioned it, I had a contribution to make. So our combined story, and that's where in a community of faith, we must be listening to the whole story and hear, oh, that's what I remember about this. And sometimes it's diametrically opposed. Somebody's telling you about these amazing good days, and somebody else says, you know, it's the worst pain I've ever gone through in my life. Brenda and I will often tell stories at home, and, you know, and Brenda will say, oh, you know, but God was, you know, just there with us, and, you know, God was right in the middle of that, and that pain just, you know, was helpful. And I'm saying, God could have figured out another way, you know. Maybe we could figure that out some other way. So it depends on your perspective, and it depends on how it touched you. Okay, how does memory shape the worship life of a congregation? All worship is in some way shaped by someone's memory. So when you plan worship on a Sunday, it is in some way shaped by your memory, if you are planning solely. So how would that play out? Can you, let's unpack that just a second. How would that play out? You would say it was in some way shaped by someone's memory, by your memory, if you were the one planning it.
You remember the response you received the last time that song was sung.
Okay. And then you say, that was good. Usually we don't put it back in unless we really have a lot of umph that week. You know, we wouldn't put it back in, but we want to replicate that. What else?
Well, the element of familiarity of a song.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And hopefully we want to connect with our memory and other people's memory. And if we've heard their story, we literally know who likes this song or for whom this song is meaningful. Yeah.
Negative two, you know, oh, I'm tired of that old gospel song. I'm not using that
yeah.
anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some songs from my childhood that it takes a good bit for me to sing. And not because they're bad songs, but when I was a kid, we had a pianist that played in our church that played almost exclusively in B-flat. So from the Brodmann hymnal, the songs in B-flat are too familiar to me. And it took me a long time to kind of figure out, you know, but by fifth grade, I figured out the pattern. Yeah, I knew we had a key problem here. Yeah. So, you know, Tell It to Jesus and I Am Resolved and, you know, some B-flat songs were kind of overused. There Shall Be Showers of Blessings, some of those. Yeah. So it can be good and bad. Yeah. So memory shapes what we do and how we do what we do. Or if we're doing something new, we have to find a place to put that. I heard a song like that. I have sung a song like that in the past that had a similar feel, or I had experience with something like that, and I believe this could also be good, and this could be new, and what have you. It could be helpful. Our faith is built around the God stories that have been passed along through the Bible and through the living witness of those within our faith community. And I'm just establishing there that it's not just, that memory's not just current, and it's not even within our lifetime, but it's all of what is going on around us and how we're shaped by that. Every congregation has a collective memory that is most readily visible in its worship life. There's a lot of worship study about whether theology informs worship or worship informs theology, and kind of which comes first. I would say that our worship embodies our beliefs. If you want to see what a congregation believes, hear what they sing, see what they are what's spoken, and then observe how it's done. And you will, if you study the dynamics of a congregation, you will know what is valued there. And if you watch and study. I'm serving in a congregation outside Waco in a small town. And I mentioned a few weeks ago to the pastor that this church is always abuzz. Like, it's really never a real quiet place. It's just, there's kind of... So what I know from that is that community and a sense of sharing is always valuable in that place. And that this kind of sharing quality permeates that place. And when you see that, you learn and you see that about the people there. And you contextualize that. It would be a congregation with a lot of people who are fairly extroverted because there's a lot of talk. You know, they like to greet, they like those kinds of things. So it's a fairly extroverted place versus a church I served in once where it was uncomfortably quiet. It was just so quiet. And I've been in other places where I would say, come on, let's bring this down. You know, it's way too much, you know. But, you know, see, you miss that when you have the extreme, you miss that. So you learn a lot by observing. Conflict arises when a sizable number of experiences in worship are not shared shared memories by a significant number of congregants. So when a So if you have these elements which are not being shared by enough people, then there's conflict that arises. Sunday at our church, a person came up to me and said, "The music that you chose this morning, I think, was exactly right." Now, the implication there is what? It's not always that way. And you don't always do such a good job. But I listened to him well, and he gave some very good insights as to how he felt this music was contextually good. He didn't cast anything about whatever else was. He just said, "This fits. This is the heart of what I think is good. Can we find..." And he did say, you know, "Is there more stuff like that?" Yeah. And I chose to say, to take that as a, as I was honored that he spoke those words. Okay, I wish that I got it right every Sunday. That would be, would please my perfectionistic tendencies better. But I appreciated his saying that, and it gave me a lot of insight, not completely into this is truth in this place, but this is his perception of the reality, at least. At least he believes that. And I put that in the context of the other stories and the other things that happen. So if you're doing well in worship, doing well, if people trust you, they will give you those, that feedback. They will give you the feedback. And if you can always remember that nobody is telling the truth, but they're simply telling their perspective. And if you can hear enough stories, then you will find some truth, pieces together, a mosaic of here's this place. And that's what we're charged to do every week in ministry, is to keep hearing that story. Now, as worship leaders, we are to continually enlarge the worship memory of the congregation that we serve. Every new experience is a part of the memory building process. So we are to be the prophetic role, in a sense, in introducing new. And one of the things we did last Sunday was new. And he said, he was saying, in my interpretation, if you're going to do new, let's do this new, not, you know, something, maybe something else. Like, this new works. Okay. And it was partly because it did touch some heart, and part of it was the way we had several people sing solos on a new song and sing part of it, so that it was... I wasn't introducing it. They were introducing it. It was theirs. They owned it. It had some heart and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. There were a lot of connections, a lot of reasons. It was a gospel kind of feel and what have you. And it resonated. And that was a good word. But we are to enlarge that. And when we enlarge that, we enlarge the memory building process. So, for instance, this week, we've sung maybe some songs that are new for some of us. So what that does is create a memory experience for you. You could decide whether I want to then take that memory or a similar memory experience home with me. You would say, well, it worked there. You might decide it would never work for me, but you might decide it could work with these modifications. And then you introduce something new, and then that becomes part of the memory. And then when you introduce it, then in just a little while, you have something that's all owned and completely new. I'm interested in the congregation that I've been serving in too, that sometimes we sing what is a relatively new song and the people respond as if they've known it forever. Like they love the song "In Christ Alone." And that means that my predecessor introduced that and it was sung a bit. Okay, for instance. So, but what if we're not attuned to those things? And we don't notice the difference. Yeah, cluelessness is not good. In order to build congregational memory, we enlarge the community's God story. We must continue to be putting ourselves into places to build our own memory. That's why it's important, and I think it's almost required, that we put ourselves into uncomfortable places sometimes. Because it expands our God story. If we can see God in places that we are not comfortable ourselves, then we believe God way more, and then God becomes bigger for us. The bigger our God story becomes, the greater possibility we have for to lead others to create a bigger God story. I think our huge failure often is that our God is too small. Just way, way, way too small. We bring God down to our own size continually, and then we just keep morphing God and, you know, just pulling God in. And we need to be going this way, which is counterintuitive at times. Leading a congregation is always about leading contextually. It's about finding the place where our story connects with others. We've alluded to that quite a bit. Again, to my most recent experience, my rural background and my rural upbringing has been very important for me to be able to contextually connect with the people that I've, a good number of the people that I've been, that I've worked with. And it doesn't mean that, you know, I talk about that all the time, but I hear the stories and I understand those stories and I value them because I can place them within something of my own memory. It occurred to me not long ago that a student I was talking to me about some challenges in a church position. And I finally said, you know, you are serving in a cross-cultural congregation, which happened to be in Waco, and it was an Anglo congregation, and he is Anglo. But his background versus this church, he could have been just as successful serving in Indonesia as he was in another church in Waco in another place, because what these people were bringing to church every Sunday was as different in his context as if he were in a place that spoke a different language and had a different cultural background. So that was very helpful to me, and lights came on to me because I started thinking that so much about cross-cultural ministry, even within people that all look the same in the same town. So it was really helpful to me to imagine that. The more memory we have, the better chance we have of finding a place where God's story can connect with others. So the more places we've been, the more people we know, the more songs we've sung, the more whatever, then I'm able to connect with Allison's song and Caleb's song and what have you, or I know something like that. Because people often, they want to help you learn what they think you've never experienced before. A few years ago, a man wanted to help me become educated, and he loaned me his whole set of Gator Homecoming videos. And he didn't know that, you know, I have an original copy of the first version of Because He Lives when it first came out. And I was there at an all-night singing in Bonifay, Florida, the summer it was released. So, you know, this wasn't new. So... What it was is we weren't singing enough of that, and he assumed I didn't know it. And that was a failure on my part. That was a misstep on my part. Recently, we had Gloria Gaither on our campus, and I got her to sign my copy, which I had kept, and I had Because He Lives, and got all excited, and a few others that came out in the early 70s when I was a young teenager. How can memory function as a catalyst for imagination individually and within the church? The greater capacity we have for memory, the greater our capacity for imagination. I have this study that I'm kind of watching. I think the people that tell the best stories usually have the best imagination. Yeah. And the people that have the deepest memories have the greater capacity for imagination. So if we want to have greater imagination, what might be an experiment or a growth place for us? Deepen our experiences. Yeah. My dad, is a wonderful storyteller, I believe. But my dad is also highly imaginative. My dad is a master procrastinator. And why do you... It's very important that I've finally figured this out, I think. Why is my dad such a great procrastinator, do you think?
It was results in a good story at the end.
Well, there's always a story to tell. He's always imagining another way something might could be done. So we were recently robbing the bees I was helping my dad rob the bees, and he's not able, which means take the honey. My dad's not really able to do that by himself these days. But we took almost all morning figuring out the best way to do this, and, you know, would it be better for us to take the wheelbarrow with us and push it all out here, and, you know, should we take them all at once, or should we make two trips? And then we didn't have enough things to do the honey, so we had to imagine, take all these containers and turn them into things that could hold these bee racks, and, you know, and all this stuff. So we figured and figured and figured and figured, and then by that time it was hot as blazes, and then we had to put all this stuff on, you know. But my dad figures and figures and figures and figures. But that comes in really well. The back door going into our backyard, the lock was messed up 5 or 6 years ago, and my dad configured something that it looks really odd, but it still works. And a repairman came and said, "Oh my gosh, did you figure this out? This is brilliant." You know? And I said, "No, my dad did that." You see, but you see the imagination and how somebody, you know, have, and you hear those stories and how that fits. Yeah, let's. What time is this class supposed to be over?
10:45.
That's what I'm sorry. I the day's different than yesterday, and it makes me get off. Memories can be intellectually and emotionally based, but I think we are most affected by emotion. And I think if we in the church could just say that's true and quit thinking that people are going to somehow be intellectually stimulated by everything and say emotion is good and it's fine and I love it and you love it and we might as well admit it. And it's okay. But it does. Emotion shapes our memory. We are shaped by what we feel. We all are. Since our God experience is ultimately by faith, we can keep putting, you know, content and content, but ultimately it's about moving into places where you can't yet see. It's about stepping into what is perceived as darkness. Expanding the memory of one component of the congregation always moves the entire congregation. So, for instance, when we leave this conference, if we were here, this is me and my circle. Because of this conference and what I have experienced, negatively, positive, whatever, I am not the same person. I will shift. If I now am here and I'm going back to my congregation on Sunday, what does my moving here do for this whiteboard, which is all of us in this field, this plane of sorts? What does that do for all of us?
It changes.
The circle changes. What happens to this space?
Somebody else will
occupy and move into that space. What happens to the people who are here? They get moved around. So my changing moves them. It shoves, pushes a little. Okay. It creates a vacuum, which then somebody else assumes, and everything shifts. What happens when 10 new families join your church that got mad at the last church? What happens up here then? And then memory conflict, perhaps. Okay, you see how one move changes everything. Now, on the positive, if we can all move a little bit, what happens to the whole scope of church music in the big picture of the meta narrative of church and church music? It can all move by little tiny shifts on the part of many people. And things can be different and can be better. Now, let's just ask the question, what questions do you have? Or in the last 3 or 4 minutes here, maybe just take some questions. I meant to leave a little more time, but I apologize for that. Some perspectives or things you'd like to share, responses or questions? Well, let me encourage you, where I am with this is I have been really trying to dive deeper into why I do what I do, why I believe what I believe, and how I am intentionally learning and hearing what is important to other people. And I'm trying to be a better listener. I'm
trying to not hold my story in, not trump other people's stories, but let my story become a part of the fabric rather than a story that rides over it.